What's up, everybody? My name is Bobby Manning. Welcome to the Bobcast, where we bring you stories of aspiration that become stories of accomplishment. Enjoy. Welcome one, welcome all to the Bobcast show. We're back here 1 week away from Christmas Eve. I'm your host, Bobby Manning. You can find me at Real Bob Manning. Follow the show. A lot of good content on our Twitter page at The Bobcast Show. And, of course, we're brought to you by CLNS Radio. It's good to be back here for episode 16, and I am so excited for this edition. It's been a long time coming, but we've have a man on the show today that I've always wanted to interview, and Christmas came early for him this year, so we're going to get to that. That's one of the main reasons it was perfect timing to have this guy aboard today. Be sure to give last week's episode a listen. Our theme toward the end of this 2016 has been CLNS Radio History. We've had a lot of the personalities here on the network aboard. Jared Weiss 2 weeks ago. Justin Poulin last week gave a fantastic interview about some of the early days of podcasting, some of the challenges he ran into, and how his show, Celtic Stuff Live, became one of the premier Celtics podcasts on the internet. So you don't want to miss that. You can find that recording, a very brief recording. We've really increased the briefness on these shows, if that's a word. So I'm very excited about that as we near the end of 2016 here on the Bobcast. Like I said, you can find that show at bobcastpod.libsyn.com. We're going to get into it here on this Saturday. Before we do anything, as I always like to, for the aspiring chefs out there, you want to chef it up like I did back in my high school days, we have a very special offer for you here on the Bobcast, Blue Apron. For all the aspiring chefs out there, anyone who just wants to put their mouth on some quality grub this winter season. It's cold outside, but inside, Blue Apron's going to warm it up with some delicious meals for you this winter. They've partnered with over 150 farmers, fisheries, ranchers, so they hit every base. That's meat, fish, veggies. All you're missing is dessert there, which I'm sure they have there for you too, but this food is fresh, coming from quality sources, and for 40 minutes or less, and for less than $10 a person, you're going to have a great dinner from Blue Apron. This month, or this week rather, I tried out the brown butter and chestnut ganache with Brussels sprouts and pea shoot salad. I'll tell you, when the dinner's hard to say, that's when you know it's good. When it's hard to pronounce, the harder it is to pronounce, the better the meal is. That's the rule. So Blue Apron, for a lot of reasons, I really want you to try out this company. It's a company I've had a very good experience with. They're affordable. There's variety. Every single week, they're bringing you unique meals, so there's never any boredom in your taste buds. They're always spicing it up. They're flexible. It's easy, like I said. In under 40 minutes, you're going to have a dinner ready to go when you get home, and it's guaranteed. They have a freshness guarantee that promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, and there's good instructions, so even if you're a mess of a chef, it's easy for anyone. So there's going to be nothing to lose with this offer, and it's an offer right from the good folks at Blue Apron. Three meals free, and that's just not three meals free, that's free shipping. So $0, 0 cents you're going to get going on Blue Apron. All you got to do is go to blueapron.com/bobcast. You'll love how it feels and tastes and creates an incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait, blueapron.com/bobcast. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. So Blue Apron, you can teach great cooking. Blue Apron proves it. What you can't teach, and he says it all the time, is awesomeness that this guy brings to the table. Our story of aspiration going to accomplishment, as we say here on the Bobcast, this guy personifies it like no one else. He's an Endicott grad hailing from the mean streets of Saugus, Mass. Worked at Sully's T-shirts, several news outlets, and now he's the host of one of the top baseball podcasts in the country. And I'll say he has the smoothest beard of any writer at Barstool Sports. We're bringing him aboard here on the weekly tour of sports and pop culture, Jared Karabas.
What's going on? How we doing?
Jared, it's so good to have you aboard, and I can't wait to dive into your story. So much great content this year from the Red Sox perspective. So throwing it way back, that's where we always start here on this show, way back before you can probably even remember. right off the bat, I got to ask you, you're one of the biggest Red Sox fans I've ever seen. I thought I was a pretty big Red Sox fan until I started reading your stuff. Earliest memory as a Red Sox fan, can you remember?
That would probably have to be my first game ever at Fenway, which was against the Marlins in, I think it was like July of 1997. So, yeah, I would say definitely my first experience going to Fenway. I remember, like, making signs before I went to the game, and my glove that I brought to the game was a Fred Lynn model glove. So, yeah, the Red Sox lost, but it was definitely my first introduction to heartbreak as a Red Sox fan.
Where'd you sit in the stadium that day?
We were probably along the first baseline, definitely along the first baseline. Yeah, I don't remember what section or anything like that, but we ended up getting season tickets the year after that.
That was your first experience as a Red Sox fan. What was your inspiration to start writing about the Red Sox, even just sports in general?
So that goes back to 2006 when I missed being able to say that I started writing in 2005 by one day, because it was New Year's Day 2006, and this was back in the MySpace days when, this was the Tom era. So basically what happened was I just had a regular MySpace page, but I knew, you know, HTML code pretty well. So I was able to dress up my MySpace page, and it had Red Sox stuff all over it. And there was this Red Sox MySpace page that was very bare, just like the default settings, but it had a pretty decent size following on it. And it was basically a message board where, you know, most people would use MySpace to connect with their friends or whatever, meet new people. But this Red Sox page was like the comment section. People would just go to post stuff during games, and it was, you know, almost like a live chat during Red Sox games. So I would go there all the time and post stuff. And then the dude who ran the page saw that, you know, like I put like a lot of effort into my personal page, and he messaged me and was like, I don't really have the time or really the desire to put anything into this Red Sox page, and you're on it all the time. You seem to know what you're talking about. So do you want it? I was like, okay. So then he gave me the login information, and it probably had like 3,000 friends or whatever. So I took it over and just redid the whole thing, and, you know, did like, you know, dressed it up to look more official. And I changed the name to Sox Space, which is the name of my first blog, and it's, you know, it's a tie into MySpace. And after a while, I think more people noticed what I was doing, and they were like, oh, you can have a profile that isn't just for a person, you can just make fan pages. So a bunch of fan pages for, you know, the Red Sox started popping up left and right. So it got to a point where I was like, all right, well, you know, if people are going to try and copy what I'm doing, then what can I do to be different from everyone? And that's when I started writing, because I was like, well, like there's a blog feature on the MySpace page. So, you know, I can do what I did before and, you know, post the stats and, you know, all kinds of news stories. But like the original writing part was something that my page could offer that no one else could. So that's when I started writing.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I feel like what makes you so unique as a writer is just the humor, the personality. There's so much in there that you don't really get anywhere else from any other Red Sox writers. And a lot of these young writers out here, you know, anyone can get going, try writing news, putting stats up there, like you said, but what do you feel like made you such an, has made you at this point such an entertaining writer? Was there a key moment, you know, in college or out of college that you feel like really helped you become a more, you know, exciting writer?
I think it was probably the 2013 season, because for the longest time, I mean, writing was my hobby, but I was always told that, you know, you kind of have to conform to a, like a journalistic style of writing if you're going to make a career out of it. And I never wanted to do that. I never wanted to not be a fan anymore. I never wanted to take my personality out of it. So I was like, well, I'll just write as a hobby, but my goal is to work for the Red Sox. So for years, I mean, I never swore on Twitter. I never swore in my writing. I used to do webcasts back in the day. I never swore on those. Very professional, because I was always trying to keep the image that I could be someone that could represent the team and work for the team. And then after a while, I just kind of was like, you know what? I don't want to work for the team anymore. And I kind of shifted my focuses elsewhere. And my goal was always to always keep my personality in it and just be me. So around 2013 is when I started to just write how I would talk normally. And it was a drastic change from how I used to write before. And I mean, I've always kind of injected like the fan personality into my writing, but not to the extent that I started to in 2013, which was more comedic, more over the top. But also it's just more my actual style of how I would like to talk about the team. And I kind of gave up on the whole working for the Red Sox thing. And that's what, like, I think when everything started to take off for me, and it, obviously, you know, the interest in the team that year was very high. So it kind of was just like a perfect storm of me throwing in the towel on the whole working for the Red Sox plan, and also just being able to cover a team that, you know, the fan base was so emotionally invested in.
You went from not swearing at all to now articles laced with swears on Barstool Sports. So you're the Red Sox writer at Barstool Sports now. What was the moment where you found out you were going to be able to get this opportunity? And, you know, kind of take me through when you first started at Barstool and what it was like to get going there.
So this was like a weird thing that happened was this was May of 2014. And I was dating this girl at the time that, I mean, she basically like looked like Barbie. So
that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it was Red Sox Nation Day. And so this was when I was still kind of like a fan representative for the team. And they would have all like the fan representatives on the field for Red Sox Nation Day before the game. So she came down to field level to take pictures of me when I was on the field. And I guess the Nesson camera guy noticed her, and there was like a close-up on her, which they recorded from the pregame and then used on the broadcast. So when they showed her on the broadcast, everyone was like taking pictures of their TVs and sending it to Barstool and saying, you know, send out the smoke patrol. So, but like I had already kind of, like by 2014, I had already established myself as somewhat of a Red Sox personality. It was more like an underground thing. But I mean, 2014, I probably had close to 5,000 followers at that point, which is not a ton, but I mean, definitely Red Sox fans knew who I was at that point. So Feitelberg ended up blogging the picture of her. And a bunch of people tweeted at me being like, yo, that's Carrabba's girlfriend, blah, blah, blah. So once I saw that, I think like I just like tweeted something harmless like, oh, shit, like Feitelberg blogged my girlfriend. And then like he saw that tweet, ended up following me, and then noticed that like I was a Red Sox writer, and he must have checked out my stuff. And it was actually Feitelberg that suggested to Portnoy that he should hire me. But I had a relationship with Dave going back to, I don't know, 2011 maybe, because there was this event called like the New England Sports Blog Awards, and Dave hosted it. And that night I won Best Red Sox Blog, and then they took the winners of the four main sports, and then they were up for best New England sports blog overall, and then I won that. And then when I won that, I was like, listen, the only reason why I won this award was because Barstool wasn't even nominated for some reason. Like, Barstool's the best New England sports blog, hands down. So, like, I'll just take this as a runner-up reward, and I'm fine with that. And then Dave was kind of just baffled that, you know, that was my big moment to go up there and just be like, yeah, I'm the best. But I was just like, yeah, I'm up here, but Barstool's awesome. So and I think that probably stuck out to him too. So we had you know, an open line of communication for several years before Feidelberg noticed me. And then when he suggested me to Dave, it was already like Dave already knew who I was and what I was all about. So it was pretty simple for him to just be like, yeah, you know, we'll try it out. And that's what he said, too, which always, like, to this day, like that kind of put a chip on my shoulder when Feidelberg was like, this guy's awesome. Like, we need to hire him. And then Dave was just like, yeah, we'll give it a shot. And I was like, okay, yeah, we'll give it a shot. I'm going to blow it out of the water. And after that, it was just kind of like, you know, there was never any suggestion of, yeah, maybe this isn't working out. And then he kind of just offered me full time. So I was like, let's do that.
What's it been like working with Dave? I mean, he's just such a revolutionary figure, and all the kids nowadays want to be just like Dave and write just like him. What are some things you've pulled from him, you know, working alongside him on the site now?
Dave has inspired my writing a lot, I think, because I think when you write for Barstool, so the one thing that I've noticed about journalists or reporters in Boston is they don't want to be part of the story. They don't want to inject themselves into the narrative of what they're writing about. But when you're at Barstool, you become part of the story. I mean, it's just you're not just a writer, you're a character. Barstool is the show, and all the bloggers are characters, and there's like developing storylines, and the readers are so passionate and loyal that they remember all that stuff. So there's different things that you can definitely inject yourself into the story, and Dave kind of, you know, he was the first guy to do it successfully and make it okay, because a lot of times readers will just be like, dude, like I clicked on this blog to read about this topic. I didn't click to read about you. But Barstool readers are just as invested in the bloggers themselves as they are in the stories that they're talking about. So, yeah, I think working with Dave, like I kind of learned that it's okay to write the way that I want to write, and you don't have to conform to some style that's traditional just because that's the way that it's always been. Dave has kind of given me that freedom to just do whatever you think will work. You know, it's just, you know, do whatever you think is going to get a laugh, do whatever you think is going to get, you know, readers to be invested in what you have to say. So, and no one else really is doing that. So that's why Barstool is so different. And I think that that's why the fan base is so invested, is because, you know, the writers are all characters. It's not just a name on a byline where it's like, yeah, I'll just click this headline just because it seems interesting. They'll click on a headline because they see who the blogger is and they really enjoy that blogger.
And talk about injecting yourself into the story. I mean, those nicknames you came up with this last season, or even going back 2 years ago, the mayor of Ding Dong City, plastered across Baseball Reference. When I saw that, I was just like, good Lord. The lawnmower, Claydro, and the best one of them all. This one's going to last decades. I'm going to be 50 years old, and when I'm talking about David Ortiz, I'm still going to call him the Large Father. That's the greatest nickname I've ever. Just sitting at Fenway Park, every time I see David Ortiz come up to the plate this last season, I was like, there's the Large Father. What was the first of those nicknames you came up with, and what was it like to see the players actually embracing some of those nicknames? I know there was a debate as to whether they actually go by them or not, but once we saw the Ding Dong City t-shirts out there, it was fact.
Yeah, it was. There was a few of them. I think the first one that I ever came up with was for Jared Saltalamacchia. I called him Saltalamaggio. Because, what was it, 2010 or 2011? There was like one season where he took forever to hit his first home run of the year. It was like mid to late May. And he hit his first home run of the year in Yankee Stadium. And a lot of them start off as like very sarcastic nicknames that just kind of stick because they're funny. And I think, so Saltalamacchia hit his first home run of the year wicked late, and it was in Yankee Stadium, and I'm pretty sure it was on, like, the date that Joe DiMaggio's hitting streak started, like the anniversary. So that's when I started calling him Saltalamaggio, and then that kind of took off on Twitter, and then they started using it on Baseball Tonight. And then I guess I asked him, like, a year later, and he was like, yeah. He's like, I heard about it because he's like, Jacoby Ellsbury watches a ton of ESPN, and he heard it. So then a bunch of the guys start, like, they call me that now when I take batting practice. So that was, like, the first nickname that took off. But people don't remember that one because that was way before like Twitter was a big deal. But like the lawnmower, I know that Pedroia calls Robbie Ross the lawnmower. Pretty Ricky, that one was Ryan Hannigan called him that in front of me one time, and I was like, that's hilarious. So then I started using a lot of it. Like, I don't even come up with these. Like, a lot of them is just like I hear it one time, and then I just kind of popularize it on Twitter. Like, the lawnmower was me. Salt of LaMaggio was me. The mayor of Ding Dong City, that one was when we used to play wiffle ball in Saugus. We played at like this on like the side of a parking lot, and a home run was off the wall, but I used to hit them over the wall, and my friend Nick calls home runs ding dongs, and then he started calling me the mayor of Ding Dong City. Like, I was the first.
Oh, so you were the original.
Yeah, I'm the original mayor of Ding Dong City, and I passed it along to Travis Shaw. But yeah, Pretty Ricky, that one was Hannigan. And then The Large Father, that was Papelbon. I remember in 2007 or 2008, Jonathan Papelbon was, like, interviewing the Red Sox players in the clubhouse and doing, like, this, like, funny video segment for Comcast, I think it was. And then he called David Ortiz The Large Father. But that was before, you know, Twitter. So I don't think that it definitely never caught on at any point, but then I just remembered it and always thought that it was hilarious. So I started using it on Twitter, and then it caught on. So yeah, I can't take credit for The Large Father. I mean, I can definitely take credit for it, you know,
popularizing
clicking,
yeah.
Yeah, like in 2015 and 2016, but it was really like a Papelbon thing from almost 10 years ago.
So Section 10 podcast, we're going to talk about that. We've talked a lot about what makes a great podcast, and this is one of the most popular baseball podcasts on the internet now. And I think one of the coolest parts of the show is that little intro you have with the piano playing at Fenway in the Section 10. How did you create that intro for the show? And with that, what do you think makes the show so popular and gives you great cohesion with your guests? And, you know, what ultimately started the show once you got going at Barstool?
So, like, the intro, that's, like, the Fenway public address announcer.
Mm-hmm.
And I reached out to someone at the Red Sox and just asked for his contact information. And I just, you know, reached out, introduced myself, asked him if he'd do it, and he did it. He just, like, he recorded it on his phone and, like, texted it to me. And then we used the audio file. And Pete was the one who kind of, like, dressed it up and, you know, he added, like, the stadium effect to it. And I think, like, the organ playing is just, like, a YouTube video that he found from, like, Fenway. There's just, like, some random person, like, uploaded, like, a video of, like, an organ playing at Fenway. And then he used that as part of the intro to kind of blend it all together. But, yeah, the whole thing behind that was Pete. I've known Pete for a long time because he was a friend of a friend. We all, like, me, Pete, and Steve all went to the same college. But none of us knew each other from college, which is bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew Pete from a friend of mine from Saugus because they – I think they became friends at Endicott. And me and Pete just clicked because, you know, he was doing the blogging thing back in 2009, 2010. Like, he was kind of – we were on similar paths for a long time. And he was kind of just like had this idea to do almost like a men's lifestyle podcast, which I was down to do. But then at some point we were like, well, you know, I have this Red Sox following. Maybe we should just do a Red Sox podcast, but it can also kind of be like a men's lifestyle podcast mixed in, you know, it doesn't have to be, the X's and O's type Red Sox podcast. And that's kind of where it started was, you know, let's do a Red Sox podcast, but let's also not take it so seriously. Like, let's not try to be, you know, an ESPN break it down type podcast. You know, let's be loose, let's be funny, but also be entertaining. And also, you know, you can still learn something. It can still be, you know, Red Sox analysis, but the point is to still be entertaining and funny and that's kind of what we did, and that's we've always been that way since day one. And then Steve just kind of came out of nowhere, just reached out to us. He fell into our laps and was just like, hey, I also went to Endicott, big Red Sox fan. Here's what I can bring to the table. And we needed a guy that could do what he did, and it just – I don't know. We totally lucked out with Steve because that was our first shot at a producer. It was just like, you know, we need a producer. Oh, here's Steve. Oh, by the way, you're a perfect fit. like chemistry-wise, yeah. He just clicks with us. Like, I feel like I've known Steve my whole life. So, yeah, he does a great job on the production side, and he also does a great job as, you know, a second or third voice, wherever you want to rank him. But, yeah, that's just where it all kind of came together.
It's funny, you start these things and you really don't know where they're going to go at the beginning, and then they just kind of, you know, go in a direction you never could have imagined it going in when you start these projects. Your work, you know, in writing, podcasting, ultimately brought you the airwaves, Comcast Sportsnet, with the big dogs over there. And I want to talk in particular about your battles with Mike Felger on the air. You know, I've heard a lot from a political standpoint, you know, going on Bill O'Reilly's show is the hardest thing to do because he's just going to interrupt you. He's going to break down whatever you say and you're just going to fold because you don't know what to do against a force as intimidating as that. I kind of see Mike Felger as being the same kind of figure in the sports world. But you have battled him so well on there. How have you been able to stand up to a guy like that on the air?
Yeah, I mean, Felger is definitely... He's Bowser. I mean, he's definitely the boss at the end of the round. I mean, if you can hang with Felger, you can hang with anyone. I mean, Minahan is the same way, but I feel like Minahan... I have a great relationship with Minahan, so there's a bunch of people that want me to go on his podcast, but I can't because I'm a Sports Hub employee, technically. I'd love to go on, but everyone is like, oh, yeah, you're scared to go one-on-one with Minahan. I was like, dude, I had him on my podcast. What are you talking about? I have a great relationship with Kirk. But with Felger, it's more like he's very – I think he's very meticulous about – how he handles media sports personalities, because I would say, like, I have Minahan's number, like, we'll text every now and then, like, he'll call me sometimes, but someone like Felger, I remember he was appalled when he found out that I had Maz's number and that we talk every now and then, because I feel like Felger does not want to get close to anyone that he works with, because if he wants to come at your throat, like, he wants to still have that option. Like, he doesn't want to be buddy buddy with anyone. Like, he's still very polite, very friendly with everyone when the cameras are off, but I feel like when the cameras are on, it's showtime, and he wants to still have that edge. Like, you know, he can say – he can make a personal dig if he wants to. He can try to make you feel uncomfortable. He can be very confrontational, which I personally love that. Like, I want someone that I can spar with, because I feel like there is a lot of that in the media where there are, you know, people that are just buddy-buddy with you. And sometimes it works. Like, I think I have a great dynamic with Zolak and Bertrand. Like, I would consider both of them friends of mine. And, like, me and Beetle will get into it, but me and Zolak, like, we'll never, ever debate each other or argue with each other. Like, me and Bertrand will argue for, you know, hours, but there's never any animosity detected in that dynamic. But with Felger, it's like, you know, you go in there to debate a topic, and it's at some point, it looks like we're just going to start throwing fists at each other. but I love that. I love that, because he can bring an element of passion out of me that not a lot of people can do in this market. And I feel like that's kind of when I'm at my best, is when somebody is taking an opposite side to oppose me that's just so outlandishly on the other end of the spectrum that it blows my mind to a degree where I just freak out on them. And that's what I do when I'm kind of going at it with Felger. And I think that it's really, really entertaining. So it works.
Well, now we know why we'll never see Felger on Twitter, I guess.
No, he'll never, ever, ever get on.
So the news of the winter that's going to get us all through the spring, even as it just keeps snowing and snowing out here in Syracuse. Chris Sale. Chris friggin' Sale. Yep. He's in a Red Sox uniform. I never thought I'd see the day. It was always a dream of mine. And I said it on the podcast last week. I was passed out cold. I was taking my Tuesday nap, woke up at 2 o'clock, late for my class. I look at my phone, and I have probably 50 texts from everybody back home. We got Chris Sale! When was the moment you heard, and what was your reaction? Were you expecting them to acquire him this offseason?
No, I wasn't expecting it at all. But I knew literally the second that it happened, because I I have like all mobile notifications for all the national writers. So, I mean, my phone was right next to me and I saw the thing pop up from Rosenthal, you know, breaking Chris Sale to the Red Sox. And I was like, what the hell? Like because it happened really fast. Like it was,
oh my God. Yeah.
The day before that, it was all the reports were pretty much that he was going to the Nationals. It was just a matter of, you know, for who, you know, it sounded like Washington had put the players on the table that Chicago wanted. It was just a matter of finding the right combination and that it was a done deal. So I had already kind of given up hope on Chris Sale last trade deadline. I felt like, you know, if it didn't happen then, because I felt like they were going to go all in for Ortiz's last season. So I didn't think that after Ortiz retired that there would be the same urgency to make a big splash and go for it, so to speak. But I guess, you know, the price came down substantially to the point where it actually did make sense for the Red Sox. Because, you know, if you're talking about putting in Benintendi and Devers and someone like Mookie or Bogarts, like that, like, that's not even a conversation. I mean, you're going to get hung up on 10 times out of 10 by Dombrowski if those are the names that you're bringing up. But this was a more reasonable package, I think. It's still a massive haul for the White Sox, but I think that it's more rational, and you can definitely explain it to the fans. But, I mean, once I saw those reports with the Nationals, I had already basically chalked it up that that's where he was going to go. And if it wasn't there, I didn't think it was going to be the Red Sox, just because they seemed so non-aggressive about it. I felt like they weren't they were kind of just saying, yeah, we'd love to have him, but – you know, here's what we're willing to offer. And there's always going to be that one team, usually, that blows you out of the water with some stupid offer, like kind of like the Adam Eaton trade.
Mm-hmm.
No one was going to put together a package that would top that for Adam Eaton, of all people. So if that's what you get for Adam Eaton, obviously someone's going to come in and give you a bigger package for Chris Sale because he's the top prize on the trade market. But I don't know. It was just, I was very surprised by it. Did not see that coming, but obviously very happy with the end result.
And I remember seeing those Nationals reports the night before, and it was blowing my mind because I was like, what are the Nationals going to give them that the Red Sox couldn't from a minor league perspective? Right. And the fact that the Nationals were in play and that the Red Sox didn't have to give up any major league-ready players and the way it came together and all the years left on his contract, I just can't wait to hear the big story of how it all came together because it's mind-blowing, the fact that they were able to get this guy with years left on his contract in the prime of his career. The only thing I can think of is that the White Sox were losing money from all the jerseys he was tearing up. I mean, there's nothing beyond that. So
yeah, it was definitely surprising. I mean, the Red Sox definitely lucked out that you know, the White Sox can't build a winning team. I mean, that's probably the biggest crime of the whole thing, besides being able to steal Chris Sale from, you know, a team in his prime with 3 years of control and only $38 million on his deal, is kind of the fact that the White Sox were never able to build a contender while he was there. I mean, I don't know how you have a pitcher of that talent and you have no urgency to kind of go out there and build around him when you have the opportunity to do that. They had several years to kind of be aggressive and go out and build a winner, and they just couldn't do it.
So some quick hits before we send you off on your day, Jared. Is Big Pablo ready to bounce back? The mayor got shipped off to Milwaukee. That mayor seat's vacant forever, like you said, but Big Pablo is probably going to have to step in the third base. Is he ready to bounce back, you think?
I honestly don't know, because, I mean, it's not like he didn't put in the work last offseason. It's just, I think he let himself go towards the end. It's almost like, you know, he thought that he could just work out November, December, January, and then just pig out in February and show up fat. And, I mean, he just did an Instagram Live video, like, maybe an hour ago.
It reminds me of that Jared Sullinger experience we had on the Celtics side. It's infuriating. And just all the posts and, ugh.
Yeah, he did Instagram Live video, and it was just him on a treadmill for about 20 minutes just running, and then him just, like, laying on the floor of the gym answering questions. But, yeah, I don't know. It's one of those things where you can show up in great shape and good for you for putting in the effort, but I'm not going to get excited about Pablo Sandoval until it's like, you know, June 1st and he's still performing well. Because even Travis Shaw, a guy that I like, I mean, he was performing really well through mid-May and then was statistically the worst offensive player in Major League Baseball from that point forward. So, you know, it'll be great if he gets off to a hot start, but even that really isn't enough for me. I need to see A, good performance, and B, a sustainable good performance. Is it possible? Sure. But is it something that I'm banking on? Absolutely not, because I think that, you know, the last 2 years have told us more about Sandoval than I think the Red Sox obviously realized before they gave him $95 million.
Who's your favorite non-Hall of Fame Red Sox player ever? Of course, we can point to an Ortiz, a Pedro, guys like that, or even Manny, who should be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion. But who's your favorite, say, like, role player, just a guy who filled, like, a really nice role over the years with the team?
It's an interesting question. I really liked Bill Miller a lot. I thought that he definitely doesn't get enough credit in Red Sox history for his contributions. I think it's because he wasn't here very long, but the impact that he made while he was here was substantial. That was the first name that came to mind, Bill Miller. Also a big Willy Mo Pena guy.
Yeah.
Love Willy Mo Pena. And then Nomar is, you know, he'll never be a Hall of Famer. He's a Red Sox Hall of Famer, but he'll never be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Nomar's probably my number one. I mean, that's my childhood hero. You know, any time that you're talking about Ted Williams comparing you to, like, Joe DiMaggio in your prime, that's a special player right there. So I would probably say Nomar is my number one.
On my end, Shane Victorino. Love what Shane Victorino brought to that 2013 squad. It was a very short stint for him here. And talk about another good nickname, the Flying Hawaiian. That was one of the best.
Yep.
So that's my – I always remember Maz wanted Nick Swisher over him too. That pissed me off. So we'll forget about that though. My friend really wanted me to make sure I asked you this before we go. I know you're a big Calhoun's guy, Saugus Mass. I'm more of a Polcari's guy myself. But what's your go-to order at Calhoun's?
Every time I go to Calhoun, I usually get an order of chicken fingers, pork fried rice, and a white Mai Tai. That's my go-to.
There you go. And before we send you off, are you what are you going to do for spring training this year as it's coming up? Are you going to be down there? Any big things planned? Because there's going to be a lot of hype going into this Red Sox season.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll try and talk Portnoy into sending me down there because he had to basically drag me to Cleveland. I didn't want to go to Cleveland.
who does?
Yeah, I had no interest in going to Cleveland. He basically, the story there was that he was like, we're going to Cleveland for the Red Sox, and then we're going to the Ohio State game on Saturday and then the Patriots on Sunday. So do you want to come? And I was like, nah, I think I'll hang back. And he was like, all right, well, you're coming. All right, I'll see you in Cleveland then. So, I think that I would definitely want to go to spring training. It's just a matter of, especially with Barstool, it's like you need to have something lined up. Like you need to – if he's going to pay to send you somewhere – you need to be providing some sort of content while you're there. So I kind of got to do my homework and see if maybe I can talk some of the players into doing some stupid video content with me while I'm down there.
Well, we're all excited for it. Check out Jared's Chris Sale episode at Section 10 Pod on Twitter. I know you're working on a blog today. Are you going to keep that secret? Do you want to tease what's coming up on Barstool this week?
I wrote about Kurt Schilling, and I guess there was some like New York columnist who gave up his Hall of Fame vote entirely because he didn't want to vote for Schilling anymore, and he didn't want to. He thought it was hypocritical that Bud Selig was in the Hall of Fame, and then there's still these debates over the steroid guys, which I agree with. It's definitely hypocritical that, you know, Bud Selig just gets in automatically, and yet all these voters are kind of asked to police who did steroids and who didn't, when really that was Selig's job, and he failed. So But the main point was that I think it's ridiculous that these writers are, you know, holding out votes for Curt Schilling because of his tweets, which I don't agree with. Like, I obviously don't stand by what Schilling says, but my point is more along the lines of it's not relevant to a Hall of Fame discussion. And the point that I keep making is you have players who play minor league baseball before they're a major leaguer. You have players who then go on to play in other leagues after their major league career, like Manny Ramirez went and played in Taiwan. But you don't look at those numbers when you're looking at a Hall of Fame case. So why is what Curt Schilling is saying on Twitter relevant to his character for a major league career? It's not. I mean, it happened after his major league career. And if you want to look at his character as a major leaguer, you would look at the fact that he won a Roberto Clemente Award, which is basically, you know, given to the greatest philanthropist in the league every single year. And he won that. He was also a big advocate for ALS research. And, you know, that's when, you know, the bloody sock game, how he had KALS on his cleat because he knew that all the cameras would be zooming in on the blood and he wanted to bring awareness to ALS research. So if you want to go by character, look at what he did as a player, and I would say that that checks out. So that's what I wrote about today.
Great stuff, great stuff. It was awesome to have you aboard today, Jared. Any big plans for the rest of the day before we send you off?
Probably just going to keep blogging. It's all there about that go. Blog life.
All right. So thanks again, Jared. Nice to have you aboard. Hopefully we'll talk to you again in the future. Have a good day, my man.
All right, take it easy.
Jared taking us from aspiration to accomplishment on the Bobcast. That's episode 16, everybody. Thanks a lot. You can find us on iTunes, and I would love if you would subscribe because we're going to have more awesome guests like Jared coming on here going forward. Like I said, find me on Twitter at RealBobManning. The show's homepage, which we're going to revamp before long. But for now, you can find all our episodes at bobcastpod.libsyn.com. We're going to have a very special Christmas Eve edition coming up next week. Like I said, I'm going to start withholding who our guests are. Keep you guys leaning on the edge before they come on, because I think that worked well here. And great stuff from Jared today. Check out Blue Apron. Check out the good stuff Jared's producing over there on Barstool and Section 10. It was awesome having him aboard today. Like I said, this was one of the most exciting interviews I've ever done. And with that, we're back to Boston next week. We'll see you there. Enjoy your week, everybody. Peace.